From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The Academy Award-winning film Pan's Labyrinth is out on DVD. Set during the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War, it's the story of a young girl's attempt to escape the horrors around her by turning to a fantasy world. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the film's screenwriter and director, Guillermo del Toro, about creating a world of fantasy and real-life horror. Pan's Labyrinth won 3 Academy Awards for cinematography, art direction, and makeup. Also, film critic David Edelstein reviews Shrek the Third. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The movie Pan's Labyrinth won 3 Academy Awards last year for cinematography, art direction, and makeup. It was nominated for Best Foreign Film and Best Original Screenplay. It's now out on DVD. Our guest is the film's writer, director, and producer, Guillermo del Toro. He also made The Devil's Backbone, Kronos, Hellboy, and Blade 2. Del Toro grew up in Mexico and has always been absorbed in fairy tales and horror films. Pan's Labyrinth is about real-world horror and a fantasy world. It's set in Spain in 1944, in the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War, when some resistance fighters continued to fight against the dictator Francisco Franco. The main character is a young girl whose father is dead. Her mother has just remarried and is pregnant with the baby of her new husband, a brutal captain in Franco's army. The captain is very cold to his new stepdaughter and to his new wife, interested only in the son he hopes she'll soon deliver. When the girl moves into her father's home, he's commanding government troops in a ruthless suppression of the resistance. She retreats from the ugly reality around her into a fairy tale world, in which she's given 3 tasks to perform in order to become the princess of the underworld. Terry spoke with Guillermo del Toro in January.
Guillermo del Toro, welcome to Fresh Air. I see Pan's Labyrinth as being about a girl's attempt to turn the ugliness around her, the war, the dictatorship, the repression and torture, and translate it into something she can comprehend, a fairy tale. What made you think about combining the Spanish Civil War and its aftermath with a fairy tale?
Well, you know, I believe that fairy tales are a way for us to understand the world. I mean, they were originally intended to be for adults, and then eventually, through the ages, once they were compiled by the Grimm brothers, especially, they became children's literature. But originally, they were created to tackle sort of inner struggles in the outside, in a fable. And I thought that war is such an overwhelming reality that I wanted to situate a fairy tale universe within the most harrowing context I could find. Originally, fairy tales were created in the middle of plague, famine, war, you know, and I wanted to pick up on that.
Are there particular fairy tales you've drawn on for the fairy tale in Pan's Labyrinth?
I've been collecting fairy tales and books of fairy tales all my life. I have, I would believe, over 150 to 200 volumes on them. And I tried to make a potpourri of themes and threads that I noticed in fairy tales that repeated themselves again and again, but not particular fairy tales. There are, nevertheless, very frontal homages to Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, The Wizard of Oz, Hans Christian Andersen, Oscar Wilde, and many other children's literature classics, including Charles Dickens and so forth.
Now, the reality part of the film is set a few years after the Spanish Civil War in 1944, yeah. So it's still World War II, and there are still some anti-fascists who are resisting with weapons. Why did you want to set it in the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War as opposed to in the middle of it?
Because I think the Spanish Civil War was quickly forgotten by most of the world, and 44 is a particularly interesting year. You have the Spanish resistance working with the Allies toe-to-toe in vanquishing fascism in Europe. You have them actively working in the north of Spain, not only resisting Franco, but sabotaging the mining operations that were sending tungsten to Germany for Hitler to build the alloy to build the panzer tanks. And you have them obviously fighting in the south of France and so forth. And nevertheless, after Normandy and after World War II, you know, the Republican side, the resistance in Spain, expects the Allies to turn their eyes back to them and help them vanquish Franco. And of course, that doesn't happen. And I wanted to show a resistance that was past their prime, if you want. You know, they were not at the height of their aid internationally. They were at the lowest point of visibility. But the resistance in Spain lasted for, at least over a decade and a half, arguably even two decades or more, and then mutated into separatist groups and people sort of splintered away and so forth. But it was decades of struggle.
And you think that the Allies should have helped Spain, should have helped the resistance in Spain?
Yes, I think morally it was a tragedy, a political tragedy, because essentially what happened is internationally, all of a sudden, it made more sense to make sort of a diplomatic alliance with Franco to keep tabs on the Russians than to help the resistance vanquish this guy. So Generalissimo Franco became, at the best for most people, a punchline on Saturday Night Live, you know. And I think that it's such a horrifying, dark time, and it's almost forgotten. I didn't want to set it up just on the Civil War. Devil's Backbone, the movie I did previously in 2001, dealt with that period, and I wanted to see what happens when everybody believes the war is over.
Now, the young girl in Pan's Labyrinth, Ophelia, is surrounded by such brutality and ugliness that the fairy tale she creates for herself is filled with ugliness, too. For instance, you know, the fairies aren't these, like, lovely, twinkly things. They're really large insects who she kind of turns in her mind into something slightly resembling fairies, but they're still, they're still kind of ugly.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about creating that kind of ugly fairy tale world? I mean, let's just start with the insect, for instance, the insect that she turns into a fairy. Were you surrounded by a lot of really big insects in Mexico?
Yes, and I'm not talking about the politicians only. I really, when I was a kid, I used to spend a lot of time in my grandmother's garden, and I would actually do insane stuff. Like, I would spend hours watching an anthill, and I would try and recognize the ants from one another every day. And I, of course, the garden was full of insects, and I would name them, and I admired them. I think that they're present in most of my movies because I have such admiration and fear of them. And I always thought that, listening to Bible tales, I don't know why, I always thought that archangels should look like insects, because archangels were sort of the tough guys of God's army, and I always imagined them looking like these shelled, armored creatures, you know. And I believed that the girl's reality in the movie, in Pan's Labyrinth, you should be able to read it as existing on her, in her mind, or as being a really raggedy, left out in the rain type of magical world, because she has been gone from it so long. So the movie allows you to interpret it both ways. For me, funny enough, to me, what she sees is a fully blown reality, spiritual reality. But I believe her tale not to be just a reflection from the world around her, but to me, she really turns into the princess.
The princess of what? The underworld.
Of the underworld. I think that there's a point in our life when we're kids when literature and magic and fantasy has as a strong presence in our soul as religion would have in later days. You know, I think that it's a spiritual reality as strong as when people say, I accept Jesus in my heart. Well, at a certain age, I accepted monsters in my heart.
Well,
and the girl is basically sort of autobiographical for me.
Well, I really understand what you're saying, because to me, like, the movie was about, in a way, the stories that we have to tell ourselves to get through life. And for a lot of people, those stories are religious stories. But for some people, they're other stories. They're literature or fairy tales or whatever. But
I think that the entire world we live in is fabricated. So when I think about, you know, Republican, Democrat, left, right, morning, night, geography, borders, all these things are conceits. You know, borders are not visible from a satellite picture. The fact that you can have a civil war where two sides kill each other and essentially from afar they look exactly the same You know, they are both the same human beings. They share the same taste for food. They sing the same songs. They, and so on and so forth. And these imagined conceits can create such horrors. And I think that when people talk about fantasy and they demean it, like, oh, fantasy is such a low concern. Well, I think politics, religion are equal inventions for me, at least.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Guillermo del Toro, and he wrote and directed the film Pan's Labyrinth. Well, you said, you know, you believed in your heart in monsters. And
I did.
What were some of the monsters that kind of formed your view of the world when you were growing up?
Well, a funny story is when I was a kid, and to these days, now and then, I have lucid dreaming. Essentially, I go to sleep and I wake up in the dream in the exact situation that I was when I went to sleep. And when I was a kid, I used to have a lucid dream of a fawn that came out from behind my grandmother's armoire at midnight, almost every day. But the funny thing is that it only happened in that room, and it only happened at midnight. So it became a constant, and the fawn in that dream is in the movie, is essentially the fawn that we designed for the film. And later in life, I found that Frankenstein was such a beautiful metaphor for teenage awkwardness, you know, for it was almost like a Miltonian hero thrown into Earth by a uncaring father. And, you know, as through my life, I found many parallels with monsters, many of them. I think monsters were created by mankind to explain the universe around them. And when we became civilized, the universe within us.
Now, you mentioned the fawn that appeared to you in your dreams that you've recreated for Pan's Labyrinth. And it's not a deer fawn. It's an F-A-U-N fawn. So
yes.
Why don't you describe what a fawn is in mythology?
Well, the movie is only called Pan's Labyrinth in English and in international language because a fawn was so hard to translate in so many languages. It sounded so obscure. But a fawn is a neutral creature. It's a creature that can bring destruction or it can bring life. It's obviously a creature of the woods that is savage and unmerciful, but at the same time as benign as nature. They care for the trees, they care for the plants and the life in the woods, but at the same time they can be instruments of savagery. And I wanted a dual creature to guide the girl into that universe. I wanted a neutral guide that was untrustworthy, you know, that the girl did not trust all the way. And actually, the more beautiful the creature turns in the movie, because it regains youth, the fawn in the movie, the less trustworthy he becomes.
Would you describe how you physically created him, like what he looks like?
We wanted very much to recreate a certain feel of these things living in the woods for so long that they had fused with the stone and the moss and the bark of the trees. And I referenced very much some symbolist painters, Carlos Schwab, Odilon Redon, Felician Robs, and mainly a few key Victorian illustrators. One of them is Arthur Rackham. And Rackham had these trees that were very twisted, very knotty, and vaguely disturbing. And so when we were creating the fawn, I said, make his legs really long and let's make them really knotted and twisted like a Rackham tree. So the fawn is this beautifully elongated, spindly figure that has sort of tree-like legs. So it's a very twisted type of design we do with the creatures in the film, the giant frog, the pale man, the fairies.
I want to ask you about the pale man. This is when she walks into one of the settings, there's this large pale man at a table, and his head has two empty holes in it, socket-like holes, and you figure those are the holes where his eyes used to be, and now he has no eyes. But it turns out, am I giving too much away here? Do you mind if
no,
I describe
I think
this?
No.
And it turns out the eyes are sitting on the table, but they belong in his hands. And what we think are the sockets for his eyes in his face are actually his nostrils from which he breathes.
Yes.
And
yes.
He holds up his eyes. He puts his hands to his face, and his eyes are in his hands, and that's how he sees. And he breathes through those two holes in his face.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
It's it's a beautiful, ugly image.
Yes.
in the way that beautiful and ugly sometimes come together.
Yes. There was a school of poetry that used to be called graveyard poetry. And I really love that because there is a melancholy in the Gothic tradition of literature that speaks about loss and fragility, but through images of horror and sometimes brutality. And I subscribe that you need the one for the other to exist. And the Pale Man is a prototypic, in function, is a prototypical ogre in the fairy tale, a devourer of children. But in appearance, I wanted it to look like essentially a monster a child could imagine, a monster from the id. What I noticed early on is I ordered first the makeup effects company to create sort of an old guy that was had been very fat and had shrunken, so the skin was loose and hanging. And at the same time, I asked them to remove the face because I remember manta rays upside down. They have this thin mouth and the little nostril-like openings, and they have a very disturbing neutrality to them. And then one of the things I remember as a kid is one of the first things you do is you draw your own hand, you trace it, and you put an eye or a mouth or a face. And it's very often that child psychologists find that one of the first things a kid does in inventing a monster is displacing the mouth or displacing the eyes. And I came up with the idea, since the character had stigmata, I said, let's put the eyes in there. And what came out was instinctively an incredibly brutal, incredibly sort of Freudian or Jungian creature.
Filmmaker Guillermo del Toro speaking with Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Guillermo del Toro, who wrote and directed the film Pan's Labyrinth, which won 3 Academy Awards. It's set in the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War.
There's so much fairy tale violence and war violence in Pan's Labyrinth. What kind of violence were you exposed to when you were growing up in Mexico?
All of it. I saw basically everything in my daily life. No domestic violence, but I did see a lot of violence on the street. I saw, you know, Mexico is not exactly a very guarded society. So there's people shooting at each other on the streets, accidents, people burning to death, stabbings, shootings. I worked next door to a morgue for a while, and I had to go through the morgue to have my lunch at the cemetery. I didn't have what you would call a normal life. I was exposed to that, and I believe that perhaps that has seeped into my films, of course, but also I believe that there is a moment in which you have to realize that violence is part of the forces in the world, and how you deal with it is important. The girl in the film, everybody else here or there chooses violence. The girl chooses not to exert it. And I feel that I have done this choice in my life too.
Yeah, well, what was your reaction to the violence that you saw when you were growing up? How did you deal with it?
It made me value what we have, the immediacy of what we have, much more. And it made me very conscious of dying and decay and fragility. I think that we live our lives sometimes believing we are immortal, and we're not. And our lives actually gain more sense when we believe in pain and when we believe in mortality. I believe that it makes us better to connect with this dark side of life. I believe so.
Now, the Spanish Civil War figures heavily in your work, in both The Devil's Backbone and, of course, in Pan's Labyrinth. How did you become interested in the Spanish Civil War growing up in Mexico?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the 80s, right after Franco had died the decade after, there was an explosion of movies and comic books, essentially underground comic books in Spain, that dealt with the war and the post-war in a very explicit and in a very shocking and a very harrowing manner. And we were exposed to it as a young adult or as late teenagers, whatever. And I remember reading those underground comic books and watching those movies and realizing at that age I had not basically heard anything beyond reading For Whom the Bells Toll. And I started reading about it, and I became familiar with how Mexico had a strong link with the Civil War, because we gave home to refugees from the Republic. And eventually, as a young man, I befriended several of them that were key figures in cinema in Mexico. One of them became sort of a father figure, a mentor figure. He was a film historian called Emilio García Riera, and he really talked to me about the Civil War and how it affected him, his family. His mother was a teacher that emigrated with him when he was 4 years old, and I started reading more and more about it.
And how old were you when you met him?
I met him in my late teens or early 20s. Mm-hmm. It was right at high school time, and he was the most prestigious film historian, and I became close to his wife and daughter and became sort of part of that family for a while. And he passed away a few years ago, 4 or 5 years ago.
Guillermo del Toro will be back in the second half of the show. He wrote and directed Pan's Labyrinth. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Villette, Charlotte Bronte's last novel, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children, on the web at covertheuninsured.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, monsters, morgues, his grandmother's obsessive Catholicism, and his father's kidnapping. We continue our conversation with Guillermo del Toro. He wrote and directed the film Pan's Labyrinth, now out on DVD. Also a review of Shrek the Third. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. Our guest is filmmaker Guillermo del Toro. He wrote, directed, and produced the film Pan's Labyrinth, which won 3 Academy Awards for cinematography, art direction, and makeup. It's now out on DVD. The movie is set in the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War and focuses on a young girl whose new stepfather is a captain in the army of dictator Francisco Franco. She retreats from the brutality and horror of his world into her own fairy tale world. Del Toro told Terry Gross in January he'd always been interested in fairy tales and monster and horror films.
You said earlier that you have monsters. You believe in monsters and you have monsters in your heart. How was the way you put it? What was the way you put it?
Yeah. But, I received Jesus in my heart, but it was Godzilla.
Yeah, but that you started to believe not in religion, but in monsters.
Mm-hmm.
And but you grew up Catholic, right? You were brought up Catholic.
Yes, yes.
And from what I read, your grandmother who helped bring you up was mm-hmm. was a very strict Catholic.
Yeah, my grandmother was essentially like Pippa Laurie in Carrie.
That's
she
scary.
She was absolutely obsessed. Yeah, she was obsessed with purity. And when I was a kid, she used to put upside down upside bottle caps on my little shoes for me to mortify the flesh as I was walking to school. And my mother discovered my feet were bleeding. And she found the bottle caps and she scolded my grandmother and she stopped doing that. But she essentially spoke to me about original sin when I was very young, a very young kid. And she spoke to me about hell and purgatory and all the things that awaited me. And that instilled the fear, a real fear in me. I was not so much afraid of death as I was afraid of where we went after death. And I truly think that horror and fantasy saved my brain from this torment. Somewhat, they were liberating and anarchistic things that allowed me to survive.
But they were about hell too, in their own ways, but just in a more fantasy kind of way.
Well, I believe there is two kinds of horror films, in the same way that there are two kinds of fairy tales, essentially. Those in favor of the establishment and those against. So there is in both genres, there is a beautiful sense of anarchy at their best, a destructive, iconoclastic, liberating sense of anarchy. I think that those are the movies that are completely in favor of the monster and of the experience of the monster and of making the human characters the scary ones. And that's what I try to do in my movies. I try to actually make the monster as attractive as I can or as beautiful as I can. Not beautiful in the, Miss Universe pageant type of way, but beautiful in the way nature is beautiful.
What did you make of vampire movies when you were growing up? Because there's Catholic iconography in vampire films. You know, like the sign of the cross is what is what makes the vampire perish.
And the drinking of the blood.
And the drinking of the blood, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So did those connect with you because you grew up with so much Catholic iconography?
They connected with me, but they connected with me I've been always very interested, for example, in the biology. I wanted to be a marine biologist when I was a very young kid, and I studied, sea, ocean creatures, deep sea creatures, and I used to make sketches of the internal organs of these creatures and so forth. And I approached vampires in sort of that curious way. My first film, Kronos, dealt with vampirism as an addiction, but not a beautiful addiction, because everyone would love to see Brad Pitt sucking Winona Ryder's neck, that's actually a very, glam type of thing to do with vampirism. I wanted to see a guy that was in such need for a fix of blood that he needed to lick the blood from the floor of a bathroom. And that was a key scene in Kronos. I was not interested in the erotic, directly erotic content of it. And I was interested in the biology and the sociology of the most base vampirism, not the glamorous one, not the beautiful rock star one.
Did you watch Mexican vampire films that I've read about when when you were young? And what were they like? I've read about ones that were shot on the same set as Dracula. So like at night, when the people shooting Dracula would take a break, they'd mm-hmm. make the Mexican version of it. So did you grow up with films like that?
Yeah, the famous Spanish language Dracula that was made at the same time as the Lugosi one, the Todd Browning one. It's actually, in some parts it's very good, in some parts it's very bad, but the Mexican films are another completely different beast. I think Mexican fantasy films have an incredible freedom about them, which doesn't necessarily yield the most coherent product. but they have an almost freestyle association of genres. You know, you can go from being a spy movie to it being a vampire movie to it being an erotic thriller without any semblance of transition. And this incredible hunger for the world of film that knows no boundaries and knows no discretion is the way I approach the movies I make. You know, I really don't give a damn. I throw myself joyously into what I believe, even if it's an absolutely non-prestigious genre. And a lot of times people look down on it. I love it. And I feel incredibly attracted to the base premises that the genre almost always proposes. And this comes from watching Mexican films.
Now, you started off your movie career doing special effects makeup. And I think you're one of your mentors was the person who did the makeup for The Exorcist.
Yes, Dick Smith. I started doing short films, and the short films I was doing became more and more elaborate with the monsters I wanted to create. And so I started doing effects also for friends in their films. They started noticing I could do squibs or prosthetics and creatures and so forth, and they started asking me for them. And I thought it would give me a real edge to get a professional course on makeup effects. So I contacted Dick Smith in New York, and I studied, took his course, and I opened my own little makeup effects company with the idea that I would use it to create the effects in Kronos, my first film, and then close it right after. And that's what I did. I sustained my company for around over a decade, and then when the time came, I closed it after Kronos was made.
How was it helpful to have done makeup special effects before becoming a director? Did it teach you the things that you could do?
Well, what is beautiful is the craft of the genre filmmaker is to create realities that do not exist. I think film is a simulation of real life, but it's more beautiful to me when it's a simulation of a surreal life, when you actually go on to creating creatures and places that have never existed outside your imagination. And it taught me how to do it. It taught me the tools to do it. I dabbled in all sorts of special effects. I dabbled on stop motion animation. I dabbled on the optical compositing. I dabbled on prosthetics, puppetry, all these things. And I believe that all that helps you to create this reality that you want.
One of my very favorite movies is the Charles Laughton version of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, in which, you know, yes, with very old-fashioned prosthetics and stuff, they created a kind of humane, monstrous look for him. And I think I read that movie was a movie you liked, too.
And, yes, I love Laughton.
Yeah,
I love him as a director, too. I mean, I love Night of the Hunter.
So I'm wondering what The Hunchback of Notre Dame meant to you as a child and as a filmmaker.
Well, growing up with my grandmother made me feel really like an outcast, because every single impulse that seemed natural to me, gearing towards fantasy, she rejected. Again, much like Ophelia with the Captain, anything that resembled imagination, she found to be the work of the devil. And I felt like an outcast. I identified with Frankenstein, and I identified with the Hunchback of Notre Dame and so forth. So they were very dear figures to my heart. You know, whether they were played by Lon Chaney or Charles Laughton, or later by a very conspicuous Anthony Quinn, who had not even a hunchback. But the figure was so powerful. It was sort of a reinvention of the fairy tale myth of Beauty and the Beast, evidently reinvented by Victor Hugo. But it is such a primal myth, Beauty and the Beast, that I was always branded by that. My grandmother, by the way, exorcised me twice when I was a kid.
She had you exorcised?
She exorcised me personally herself.
Wow.
Twice, because she hated the things I would draw, or the things I would talk about, or the sculptures I would do. And, I think that I haven't had a bad review that bad in my career.
Did you ever think that maybe you were possessed by demons?
Well, I thought about I was a firm Catholic believer. I was a choir boy. I was a member of the Virgin Mary Society, and I was this and I was that. And then when you reach your teenage years, I discovered that the world was much wider. I started working, as I said, in a place that I had to go through the morgue, and one day I saw such a horrifying sight at the morgue that instantly showed me there was no real order in the universe, at least not a conscious order dictated by a guy in white robes and a long beard. And it really shook me. And so in my teenage years, my early teens were very difficult living with my grandmother.
What did you see?
I saw a pile of fetuses that was about 5 feet tall. And it was such a harrowing variety of things there going on at every level. I just realized, I guess we are on our own, you know, so we better make the best of it. But it's this world that I saw that made me love with a passion the world that I was creating. Because the world that I was creating, in which I had a semblance of control of the things that happened and how the stories ended, became a lifesaver for me.
Do you remember what your grandmother did when she tried to exorcise you?
Yes, of course. Yeah, she had always a little bit of holy water in the living room, and she had her little box of Catholic trinkets, and she had holy water there. Don't ask me why, but she always had a little. And I was drawing monsters and doing things, and she said to me, "Why don't you draw something beautiful?" And I said I wouldn't, and we started arguing back and forth, and she went for the holy water, and she started praying, saying an Our Father, and she started tossing the holy water at me, and I started laughing. But I started laughing at how ridiculous it was for a grown woman to be doing this thing to a kid that was drawing monsters. And she was so scared about me laughing, and she started screaming, don't you dare laughing at the holy water. And I was saying, I'm not laughing at the holy water. I'm laughing at you using the holy water. But, you know, it was beyond repair. I think that the one thing I learned in loving my grandmother is that you can love someone not for their qualities, but for their defects. You can love someone because of their difference with you, not because of their similarities with you. And I think it was an important lesson in my life.
Filmmaker Guillermo del Toro speaking with Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Guillermo del Toro, who wrote and directed the film Pan's Labyrinth.
You know, in talking about some of the horrible things you've been exposed to in real life as opposed to in your fantasy life, in 1997, your father was kidnapped for ransom.
Mm-hmm.
And was released, I think, after 72 days.
That's correct, yeah.
Why was he kidnapped? Why was he chosen?
Well, it was purely, you know, the these things are run like franchises, or were run like franchises in Mexico, you know, and they target people that have a certain profile and they go for them. It was purely commercial, you know. They were doing a little commercial venture, those guys, and the side of mankind, or the side of society that you see through the kidnapping, it's quite harrowing. I mean, you are not only exposed to the fact that the kidnappers are doing what they do, but the fact that society has a certain strata politically, and in terms of Mexico, the police, some of the police work, and that is as corrupt as you can ever imagine. And you get exposed to a whole new world. It's almost like somebody lifts the rock of reality and allows you to see the underbelly of it. And you never see reality quite the same.
Were you involved in the negotiations or anything?
I was. I was with my two brothers. I took the last leg of the negotiations. My older brother took the first. My younger brother took the second, and I took the last leg of the negotiations. And it's It certainly was quite an experience.
Is this why you don't live in Mexico anymore?
Yeah, unfortunately, I had to be exiled of it involuntarily because I'm a family man and I didn't want to expose any of my family to it, not any longer.
You know, we were talking about how people need stories to tell themselves to help them get through life, and for some people it's religion. For you, it was fairy tales and horror stories and monster stories. Do you feel like you still need stories in your life to help you make sense of life? And what stories do you turn to now besides the ones that you create?
Absolutely, I do. Absolutely, I do. I mean, during the kidnapping, one of the things that the negotiator tells you is he tells you, what do you do for a living? And you say, I responded, in my case, I write. I write and direct. And he said, then go write every morning. And I found myself writing every morning my fantasy stories to escape, because those 2-3 hours I would be able to dedicate to my creatures and my stories in the morning would absolutely give me the energy and the power to get through the day in that harrowing situation. So I need them. I need them. And many times a good story has saved my sanity at the very least, and sometimes my life. I mean, there are moments in my life where I have felt so low and things have been so adverse that all of a sudden I read a story that moves me to tears, and I see the world in a different way. I think that's the power of any art. But in my case, my proclivity, of course, is towards monsters.
You've described Pan's Labyrinth as a parable of disobedience and choice set in the aftermath of the Spanish Civil War. And that left me wondering about the times in your life outside of when you were young and you were disobedient of your grandmother, but about the times in your life when you were disobedient and when you made difficult choices that could have gotten you into an adult form of trouble.
Yes. Well, many times, including, I mean, just again, the kidnapping is such a crucial occurrence. You are faced constantly with that type of choices during an experience like that, every day, at every turn. You know, and you encounter things that go wrong every day. I remember going through to the bank, for example, to try and open a safety deposit box, and they wouldn't let us open it. Even although we had the key or key, and they wouldn't allow us in because they were afraid if my father didn't survive, we wouldn't repay the loan he had taken. And they were doing things completely illegal. And I would tell the guy, this is completely illegal. And the guy said, I just follow orders. I don't make them. And that, I find, you know, that type of obedience where you find refuge in the corporate, or when you find refuge in the political or religious majority, is such an absolutely despicable cowardness. You know, the cowardice that the captain displays by making the others non-human so he can torture or kill them. And I think that every time you turn towards a truth that is not your own, that you confide the guidance of your soul to somebody else's choices, you are making a huge mistake. And even although I have done every kind of movie, commercial, non-commercial, smaller, larger, every movie I have made, it has come from my heart, from a desire to tell a romp, to tell an entertaining story, or to tell a moving story. And I have, to this day, and I knock on wood, I have not done a movie just to do a movie, just to get a check or just to get by. And those are choices that also you face every day.
I take it, by the way, that your father survived the kidnapping okay?
Yes, he did. Now every time I see him, I demand for him to do something entertaining because he was so expensive. I say, Dad, sing, do something, you know. you know, we booked you for life.
Does he still live in Mexico?
Yeah, he does. He's an extraordinarily strong man. Mm-hmm. Extraordinarily strong.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, no, my pleasure.
Guillermo del Toro speaking with Terry Gross in January. He wrote, directed, and produced Pan's Labyrinth, which has just come out on DVD. Coming up, had enough Shrek yet? David Edelstein reviews Shrek the Third. This is Fresh Air. In his 95 years, the late writer and cartoonist William Stigg created quite a few misunderstood giants, but none, thanks to movies, as popular as the lovable, coarse ogre Shrek. In 2001, Shrek became the star of a computer-animated film voiced by Mike Myers. Shrek 2 followed a few years later, and now we have Shrek the Third. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
When I was a kid in the 60s, my parents routinely dumped me and my little brother at the movies, where we'd see pitiful imports like Santa Claus versus the Martians, or slapstick comedies with Dean Jones and a willful dog or ghost or Volkswagen. But nowadays, at least in my protective circles, adults go with children to what studio executives call handhold movies, movies for grown-ups and kids. There's action and tomfoolery and goody-good life lessons for the youngins, non-stop pop culture in-jokes for adults, and fart gags for everyone. In the last few years, I've held my kids' hands through great movies like The Incredibles and Finding Nemo. Shrek the Third is not in that league, but it's a flat-out triumph of comedy writing. I'm guessing there were many drafts by some of the best gag artists in the business, and then gloss after gloss by astronomically paid rewrite people. Computer-generated animated movies with wall-to-wall jokes can be unbelievably irritating, but these jokes are the best that money can buy. I should say, I'm no Shrek pushover. I found the first film laborious, ugly, and whenever Eddie Murphy's donkey sidekick was rolling his eyes and making arch comments like so-called colored help in old movies, excruciating. But the sequel was lighter on its feet, and by kid movie standards, rather subversive. The fat green ogre Shrek, voiced by Mike Myers, married the willowy blonde Princess Fiona, voiced by Cameron Diaz. And it turned out she'd been under a spell. She was a fat green ogre herself. The only problem was that she and Shrek weren't allowed to live happily and grossly ever after in the swamp. The kings and queens and fairy godmothers and Prince Charmings wanted her skinny and blonde again. Shrek, too, had wave upon wave of parodies and inspired vocal turns. Shrek the Third has more. It's a busy movie, crammed with plot. Fiona's dad, voiced by John Cleese, is on his deathbed, and Fiona and Shrek are expected to carry on the pomp and circumstance. But big, flatulent ogres and royal protocol don't mix. Shrek wants to wallow in the swamp with his beloved wife and beloved vermin. So he sets out to find another heir to the throne, one Arthur Pendragon, a nerd at a medieval prep school across the ocean and voiced by an engaging Justin Timberlake. Shrek and his two sidekicks, Murphy's insufferable donkey, and Antonio Banderas' swashbuckling feline, who somewhat compensates for the donkey, pull out to sea, whereupon Fiona stuns her husband with the news that she's pregnant. Shrek 2 introduced, hilariously, a host of figures from other fairy tales, and Shrek the Third pulls out the stops. The spurned Prince Charming, voiced by Rupert Everett, assembles a crew of defeated fairy tale villains like Captain Hook and Rumpelstiltskin to take back the kingdom. Here's Prince Charming torturing Pinocchio, whose nose gives him away when he lies, forcing him to sound like the typical White House spokesman.
You!
You can't lie. So tell me, puppet, where is Shrek?
I don't know where he's not.
You're telling me you don't know where Shrek is?
It wouldn't be inaccurate to assume that I couldn't exactly not say that is or isn't almost partially incorrect.
So you do know where he is?
On the contrary, I'm possibly more or less not definitely rejecting the idea that in no way, with any amount of uncertainty, that I undeniably do or do not know where he shouldn't probably be. If that indeed wasn't where he isn't. Even if he wasn't not where I knew he was,
Enough! Shrek went off to bring back the next heir! Oh!
He's bringing back the next heir.
No!
Hook! Get rid of this new king.
Right!
But bring Shrek to me. I have something special in mind for him.
Prince Charming wants to stage for the kingdom a traditional fairy tale in which he gets to slay the ogre. But what happens when he and Shrek face off before the throng is a nerd's dream. It's where wit conquers good looks. Shrek the Third has clunkers. It uses old rock songs promiscuously. And whoever thought it was a good joke to play Live and Let Die at the king's funeral should re-examine that decision inside an Iron Maiden. But the bodily function jokes fit happily into the picture's slob-happy worldview. Early on, Shrek wakes up beside Fiona and nuzzles her. Morning breath, he says, laughing. Isn't it wonderful?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Loggeria, a collection of tales from imaginative storytellers edited by John Klima. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And from Fox Searchlight, presenting Waitress, an uplifting comedy by Adrienne Shelley about a small-town girl with big dreams, now playing in select theaters. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we celebrate our 20th anniversary as a daily national program. It's hard to figure out which interviews we could play that might sum up 20 years. So we're going to bring our producers into the studio to choose Fresh Air moments they remember and play them back for us. Join us for the celebration.